Welcome to Toys on Tap. This week is a favorite of mine. The second episode, we thought we would do more, but we realized why split it up even more and put it into the second episode with Paul Kaiju, or Paul Copeland. He's an incredible artist who has been in the soft vinyl Sufubi scene for a very long time, starting with model kits and moving forward, working with Japanese artists and factories to bring his art to life, and you get to hear about it here on Toys on Tap. If you want to support the show, you can follow us on all socials at Toys on Tap. You can like, subscribe, rate, review. That's what brings in more people so that this can grow. If you want to jump on the Patreon, we have adjusted. It's $3. No tier system, $3. That's all that matters to us. We want to get out content as quickly and as cheaply as we can, and so we're working on stuff. I've lagged behind, and I decided I wanted, especially with the economy the way it is, to make it as cheap as possible. Now, let's get to this week's episode of Toys on Tap. Paul, welcome back to Toys on Tap, your second episode. And after thinking about it, I realized I was trying to split it where we might not have needed to split it. Because this episode's about your early art career and early toys. But I don't know that I want to stop my own conversation with you and have another episode of just later toys.
Yeah, whatever floats your boat.
Yeah. So please introduce yourself once again and tell us who you are, what you do.
My name is Paul Copeland. I'm known as Paul Kaiju. I make vinyl, I sculpt vinyl toys that are produced in Japan, and I paint them here in sunny San Diego.
Heck yeah. And I mean, we talked about this last time. There's nothing worse than finding out that the person that you love watching paint and stuff has always lived a couple streets down from you. And then I moved. So this is the life of a toy maker.
Yeah, my best friend from high school actually lives not too far from me. I found out later after we'd lost contact.
Yeah,
that's crazy.
So we last episode we kind of walked through the beginnings of your early career of just learning art and getting in touch with those things and having this almost like punk rock-esque scene of early toys and figuring out what vinyl was and all that. And we kind of encroached on the beginnings of your art career. So kind of take me back to the year that you started making art outside of working for the air company and then
aerospace.
Yeah. So take me to that point where we're starting to make art at least a little more seriously.
I mostly during the time I was in aerospace, which was 1987 on to about the mid 90s, I was still building model kits. I was mostly, you know, the weekends I would tell my friends, you're not going to see me. I'm going to be building model kits all weekend.
Yeah.
You know, and, I dabbled in a little sculpting, but overall during that time, you know, it was very hard to find the clear path of time. Cause you know, you went to work, got up at 4 a.m. and got home at 4. You're too tired to do anything.
Yeah.
You know, so I mostly weekends, you know, I went to model collector shows and would come back with like SF 3D kits and different, you know, I built Gundam kits, early Gundam. They're crazy now, but I built like the real simple Gundam kits. Monster kits, early vinyl monster kits. I entered a couple model hobby contests. My dad was a model builder too. Mm-hmm. So I entered a couple model building contests and I didn't win my first one, but I got a second prize on my second one for a Baragon vinyl toy because nobody had seen that stuff.
Yeah. Are we talking they judge you based on like how clean it looks, the paint, all that stuff?
Yeah. It was funny. I scratch built a robot for the first one and I didn't place at all. And then the second one, the guy that got first on the contest before me judged me for second.
Oh, cool. Cool.
But it was just a Baragon vinyl model kit. And yeah. I gave him a little car for scale. And yeah, I got second place. And my dad, he'd always win. He'd always, his planes were 1/72nd scale, amazing. Yeah. That's small. That's like really small.
And I get, he probably had like glasses and like magnifying glasses and stuff.
That was back when his eyes worked really well.
Yeah, I remember.
But I got these now.
Like as a little kid trying to do models and I hated it. I could not focus. ADHD was like taking control of my brain.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And so that's cool.
He would scratch. I saw him. He scratch built a tank once out of scratch plastic. He used to make his vacuum form his own canopies. And one day, after discovering who H.R. Giger was, decided I wanted to try more airbrushing.
Okay.
So I went and took his compressor and his airbrush. and he didn't get mad.
Yeah.
You know what he did? He went out and bought another one for him.
What up, toy nerds? This is Ray.
And Dave. Go check out our brand new YouTube channel, The Toy Rats.
We make toys.
We talk about toys.
We talk about old toys.
And new toys.
And toys that we make.
And we're just a bunch of goofballs. It's a good time.
We make fun of Dave a lot.
I'm all right with that. So if you get a chance, go check out Toy Rats on YouTube. You won't be disappointed. You might be.
Yeah, you could. Who knows?
You gotta check it out.
Toy Rats. YouTube.
Bye.
Okay.
He goes, he was happy to see it. You know, like, he's like, good. Let him go at it. I'm not gonna, you know. It was pretty surprising my dad didn't get mad. He didn't. He just went out and got his own stuff. Because he was happy seeing me do that.
Yeah. That's cool. There's something cool about not only toys in general and painting and all that stuff, but the bonds that get formed and the ones that start early on between parents and kids, if the parents get it.
Yeah. Yeah. We had a good creative bond over model kits and stuff and sci-fi and stuff. We were like two peas in a pod with all that stuff, you know? So that was pretty much my culture.
Yeah.
You know?
Where's the middle ground where model kits almost start to fade out because you're seeing like other toys that you want to make or figure out how to do?
Where I think it really shifted, and I thought about this the other day, was there was a magazine called SMH.
Okay.
Out of Japan. And it was art meets model kits.
Okay.
And I got a couple issues of it and was just, this is where it's supposed to go.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's where I shifted into going, it's game on, because this is where, you know, there was some amazing model kit and scratch building models at the time, but the scene in Japan was insane.
Mm-hmm.
There's some of the artists in these magazines were incredible. I'd never seen anything like it.
Yeah.
And the thing about model kits though, is they take up a lot of room and they get real dusty. Whereas vinyl toys, you can play with them, you can touch them, you can put them on a shelf, you can, you know, that's why I always joke, I'm glad I don't do porcelain, because I get the drops, you know, the dropsies.
Oh, yeah.
And you ship, you know, you pat it up nice, but that's why I don't miss about resins. Resins get real brittle, and I've had to fix a lot of resins, but mostly in this SMH magazine, I was seeing the path that toys and art could come together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we could have that. We can have something unique in that.
Yeah.
And even though there was some kind of imagery in this magazine of toys too, like, but I was so into the vintage stuff and also getting all these other magazines that I saw the cross. I saw the pathway.
Okay.
So that eventually got me thinking that I could eventually maybe have a toy or I wanted to participate in it.
Yeah.
In a, I didn't know it would become a scene. Mm-hmm. You know, the designer toy thing had started to kind of, I'd say, what would you say was the big, you know, like Dunnies and the designer toys?
Yeah, you have like early 90s, and Michael Lau.
Late 90s.
Yeah. So late 90s, like the beginnings, maybe 2000,
yeah.
2004-ish.
This is before that. You know, I was kind of hoping for that.
Yeah.
You know, but I wanted Japanese vinyl in that.
Yeah, yeah. Is there, did you notice that Japanese vinyl, I mean, in looking at the history of soft vinyl toys and Sofubi in Japan and all those things, did you notice that it wasn't taken as seriously here, even though it was just booming there?
It wasn't.
Okay.
I remember the first time I ever saw any of the new wave of vinyl and what would be is, I think I saw a picture of Bloppus and Mori and Reelhead. Mm-hmm. And these were their first figures.
Yeah.
And I was like, I want that.
Yeah.
I want that. What's going on? What is going on with this? You know, and I think it took me maybe 5 years to find it's about 3 years to find my first Bloppus figure. Mm-hmm. And I would eventually work with him and meet him and, you know. That when I saw that kind of coming up, I do think it took everyone a long time to warm up. Mm-hmm. Because believe me, some of the toys coming out of Japan, eventually I was confused when I first saw them, but I got it. I got, you know, and there was a lot of kind of myth thrown on them. Like, you know, especially like pollution monsters and who makes this, you know, they're expecting some mad scientist in a cave making these things. And you know, so a lot of these, some of these real obscure toys have more of a story behind them.
Yeah.
You know, or their personal mascots, or not so much, you know, a pop thing. And and that was to me very interesting, showing that could be done. You can make your own thing. There can potentially be a scene for that. And even if there's not, you want to do that.
Yeah.
You know, and eventually the scene kind of rose. It was all very community based, you know, everyone kind of looking out for each other. And there was a couple sellers that eventually appeared in the States that would get boxes of stuff. And if you didn't get their email, you didn't get.
Yeah.
And I think that was really, really amazing times. And also during those times, companies like Gargamel and even M1 were releasing some blanks, where that's where I learned to paint vinyl toys. And also I began doing commissions. You know, like people could send me a blank, and for a certain price, depending on what they wanted, I would paint it for them. So I did that. I did that for probably 3 or 4 years.
So, I mean, I do have to ask, because at this point, this is early on painting for you, and this is different paint than normal model kit stuff. Are you painting these vinyl toys with like typical paint you had for model kits?
No, I learned early on that acrylics do not work on vinyl.
Great.
The chemicals don't bond. Mm-hmm. So at the time there was Hobby Link Japan, which sold a paint called V Color.
Okay.
So a couple people would order from them.
Yeah.
And it took us a while to learn, if you didn't put enough thinner, it came out like cobwebs. You had to add a lot of thinner to it, and eventually learned how it worked. Mm-hmm. We didn't have a Goto-san to guide us and show us. You got to mix, you know, one-to-one. And so there was a couple other artists I connected with at the time, and we would compare notes. And then it got to the point where everybody wanted to paint vinyl.
Yeah.
And that led to problems with the shipping of the paint. So then that was no more. It got, they said, we can't do it. We can't ship it anymore.
Because of toxicity?
Because of flammability.
Okay. What year is this?
This must have been, I was still in Long Beach. This must have been 2000 or about maybe 99, 2000.
Okay. So it kind of puts things on hold then, or you just have whatever paint until it runs out?
I hoarded.
Yeah, you did.
I had quite a bit.
Okay.
And I was making it last pretty well. But we were all starting to strain. Where are we going to get paint? Where are we going to get paint? And lucky for me, by the time, Chica from Gunzo also released Mad Ape Ninja paint, which helped a little later.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, I went to Japan and made ties with the factory and was able to order FOK.
Yeah.
Which is the main factory paint that they
use. As you're painting these vinyl toys that are coming in, I have two questions that kind of go along with this. One, what are these early vinyl toys that you're painting? Just 90s kaiju monsters?
There was M1 released Lucky Bags, which were filled with blanks.
Yeah.
And so they kind of flooded out. People were trading them and selling them. Matango, Dada, all these, they were all blanks.
Yeah.
I painted a bunch of Matangos. there was a lot of yellow Matangos out there.
Yeah.
And then Gargamel also did Lucky Bags, which had blanks. Excuse me. And then there was a company called Kaiju Toro. It was an online store.
Okay.
And they started selling white blanks.
Okay.
Like from Real Head.
Yeah. And
from what I understand, they weren't authorized. This was not an authorized thing. But anyway, when they did, everyone started buying those up.
Mm-hmm.
And I still have a couple in my collection I painted for myself.
Mm-hmm.
So that opened up the freedom a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, but I happen to know that some of the artists weren't exactly happy about all that. But I was always eternally grateful.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'd go to Japan and tell them that, you know, how grateful I was that I was able to paint their toys.
Yeah.
And because even though I was painting toys, it really inspired me.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I mean, early on, because you're just like, it sounds like it's the Wild West. All these toys come in and people, they're just, you're learning because there's not really a market yet. You're learning all the ins and outs of what's allowed, what's not allowed. And I think that that's just like every art scene goes through that, right?
Yeah.
And so you were just the beginning of what this looks like.
It was the Wild West. It's, you know, and I've seen it happen to other things like modular synthesizers. You know, there was maybe three manufacturers in the United States, and now there's thousands.
Yeah. You go from painting them and to having these almost like starting this collection, right? Like your vinyl is now entering, which I don't know what this area is called when it starts this. You know, Brian Flynn and Mark Nagata early on, there's reference of something called like a neo kaiju something, or like a boom that's happening after the die-off period. And as they start like flooding this way, people like you are just painting these things and like collecting and doing stuff. What kickstarted the idea that you could make one?
I also collect. Okay, let me say, before the vinyl started flowing in like that, I painted squeak toy animals.
Yes, you did. Do you have any of those in your collection still?
I've got I used to take the Kewpies to Japan and have artists draw them, and I've got a Wamo one and I've
awesome. Got
a couple of them. But I also collect squeak toy elephants.
Okay.
I went to the Rose Bowl once and bought three, and I'm like, there's got to be more, and there's literally hundreds of different ones.
Yeah.
You know, so I was really into the form. I like the Kewpie form. I really like the cute, simple form of those, but not. I thought those could be brought up a little bit, you know, in my form. So I decided to do my own elephant monster, which was Boss Carrion.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of gave him, I was inspired by the squeak toys to sculpt him. So I had hit up a friend in Japan and showed him a picture. He goes, I can help you make that.
Mm-hmm.
So I sent to Japan and Boss Carrion was born. That was my first completely solo toy project.
Yeah. And this is early on. So we're talking, you're like, the process is so new.
Yeah.
And so are you, I mean, I don't even know how to ask. Are you one of the first Americans that's like indie artists that's trying to work with Japanese Sifubi when you do that?
I think I was like, okay. There was maybe two or three at the time.
Okay.
If I think I've been speaking with a friend about it, but I'd seen other, when I was at the Mad Model parties I'd seen someone that was doing other things with it. Like they made like a Popeye, but it was vinyl. Yeah. It was being done,
mm-hmm.
but not to the point of kaiju and monsters like that.
Yeah. This first toy, I think because this kind of kicks off toy career for you in an alarmingly large way. Tell me about the designing process of this first one. Like, what were the things that kind of poured into it to make it what you wanted?
I didn't do any sketches. Most of my toys, I don't do any sketches.
Okay.
Because I just don't, I think it's, when you design Sofubi, the form has to be pullable.
Mm-hmm.
So in my mind, I know the angles.
Yeah.
And what can't be done. And you want it to be easy to produce. And nothing hanging up. No undercuts.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of the form about Sofubi I like, because it's got to be a little simple.
Yeah.
It's got, you know, and you can see it in the early vintage toys, how they're very simplified. And I kind of like to keep that form.
Mm-hmm.
So what I do and how I do it is I do tin foil and make the form. Then I cover it and I bake it and then remodel those to fit. I do all the jointing and everything, because when I draw it, I'm not going to match it anyway.
Yeah.
Because you know, the angle of the arms, mm-hmm. the angle of the legs, the angle of the feet, the tail, whether parts can avoid bumping into each other.
Mm-hmm.
On the interior, because that happens, a neck can bump into the arm plugs.
Yeah.
You know, so you have to consider all that. And I've hacked figures to bits over weeks trying to get all the balance correct.
Yeah. How did you learn about all of that? Because this seems like the first time that has happened in your story, where all of a sudden is just trial and error.
Boss Carrion was perfect. He didn't need any modifications.
Okay.
Salamander Joe didn't need. The only recommendation I got was the feet need to be bent up a little bit, because when they're pulled, they bend down a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what you want, the figure to stand straight. But if you don't angle them up a little bit, you'll end up with a forward-leaning character.
Yeah.
And I think Unchi Man, I had to add I had to add a little meat right here, so he was tilted up a little bit. Because when he's pulled, he would lean forward too far.
Okay.
But you got to learn stuff like that. Yeah. And then the factory, if they find something, they'll send you a picture and modify it for you.
I love factories for doing that kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah, they'll fill it or they'll build it up. Or there's been a couple times where I had to redo a part because you can't go too thin. Like with antenna, they have to be like a chess piece, like a chess pawn.
Yeah,
very wide. If you do them too thin, they come out looking like a deformed Q-tip.
Yeah.
So I had to redo antenna.
Yeah.
What else? Maybe a foot, a foot needed to be redone. But most of the time, if they can fill under it with wax, it's easy for them. So
yeah,
they'll do it.
In making the first one, tell me about how long the process was. I mean, at this point, we're probably at like 3 to 6 months. If I push really hard, I can get a mold, test pull, and production done. It's fast, but it's like, we can make it happen. So how long is this first one?
A couple months.
Okay.
Yeah. And then when I really started to produce more toys, I went by the rule, don't count your chickens.
Okay.
And I would literally stock up ahead because there was a moment the factories got really bogged and you didn't see things for a very long time. Yeah. It goes in waves.
Yeah.
I think they hire new people. People retire.
Yeah.
And I remember one time, I think the quickest I ever got was a month.
That's crazy. Including shipping.
Like, everyone was hitting me up going, how did you? Yeah. Every within a month.
Wow.
Yeah. It was crazy. Everyone's like, how did you get all the other makers were like, how did you get that so fast? But it helped that I'd flown to Japan and visited them, you know, and show my face and have dinner with them. And, you know, that's good business.
Yeah, that is. I mean, eventually that's the hope I want to get to where I like fly out and hang out with them and stuff.
You should.
When you are making this and you get these. There's this early on thing, even in the last couple of years, of where people don't tell factory stuff, which is fine. Keep that. The reasoning that I've heard that they give sometimes is they don't want to bog down the factory.
Well, I think we're well beyond that now.
Yeah,
you have companies like, you know, like Metacom, they're making a lot of vinyl toys over there now.
Yeah.
Everybody's making vinyl toys now. People that used to buy my toys are making vinyl toys now.
Yeah.
It's crazy. It's really exploded.
And it's so accessible.
It's accessible. And that's just, I'm glad the hobby's taking off.
Yeah.
You know, we need more people collecting. We need more shelf space. We need more Deltops out there.
Yeah.
You know, because people are making some cool stuff. And then, you know, Asia and China is really, really big on making, producing now. And I prefer the Japan production.
Yeah.
I'll pay a little more for it, but I like the quality and the factory, I think, has faith in my work that they're not going to get a hassle.
We interrupted this broadcast of Toys on Tap to bring you this. Meanwhile, in a galaxy of bootleg treasures.
DOV2, we have engine failure. We must crash land on DKE Toy Planet. Oh my, we're doomed. Wait, salvation. Hooray, we're saved, DOV2. Limited edition custom artist made action figures and DKE toys.
Check out www.dketoys.com for a full catalog.
Hooray for custom action figures.
DKE with weird parts, you know, everything I send them is pretty cut and dry.
Yeah.
And it just goes right through.
Awesome.
So I like to give people advice. They'll show me a toy. I go, you got to redo this part. You know, I'll help people. I like helping people.
Yeah.
And they also, I'm sorry, there's a shrinkage too. It has to be
There is.
Yeah,
and that
yeah.
Was there's a thing I learned the hard way.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, we wanted a toy a certain size, but it definitely there was.
It will shrink.
Yeah,
it will shrink, and so that's why when you sculpt for Selfie, it's got to be a little thicker.
Yeah,
you've got to go a little thicker. Too thin, it's gonna look crumpled and emaciated.
Yeah, when this weirdness of how accessible it is. When people do ask, the question now seems to be, or the answer now when they say like, oh, can I make this or should I make this? Do you think the question has shifted from, you just need to find a factory to, because factories are now dime a dozen everywhere. Now is the answer, yes, but do you think it will sell or do you have a market for this? Do you think it has slowly shifted to that because there's so many producers now?
I'm not opposed to anyone mm-hmm. going for their dream.
Yeah.
And that's how you learn. Mm-hmm. If you make 1,000 of something and you don't know if it's going to sell and you're stuck with them, you've learned a lesson. I hope you didn't spend too much.
Yeah. Big lesson. Yeah.
But that's the good part about the community. And I, you know, because that's mostly where I got a lot of my support, you know, and I posted a sculpt, people go, oh, that's great, you know, and amazing. And, you know, I want that when you make it. And it's like, I have that ability at the time to gauge mm-hmm. what would work, you know, and I was lucky for that. The community, I gauged by the community.
Yeah.
Now it's a lot harder. You know, people, you go by, you know, you can't go by likes, you know, but, you know, people chime in, they'll, mm-hmm. they'll tell you if they like something, you know, that's why we have friends, you know, they'll look at it and go, don't make that.
Yeah.
Don't do that.
Yeah.
But then I like to be, I'm making art for me.
Yeah. You know?
And that's another thing is like, if you want to do it for you. You don't want to do it to impress. And you make some money, but if you can do your thing,
yeah,
and make some money, then that's great.
Yeah.
Are you happy with did this make you feel happy with yourself and what you accomplished? You know, and then you have to recoup for the molds.
Yeah. Bare minimum.
You have to recoup.
Yeah. I tell people when we partner and I'll help you create your toy, bare minimum, you see nothing until molds and production are covered because mm-hmm. I have to cover myself in this. And that scares some people off because it's a requirement that your art does well for at least a little bit.
Yeah.
And that's tough.
Yeah. I was very lucky.
Yeah.
You know, I went from a hobby into a serious business
mm-hmm.
and it was really fast. You know, I'm like, I'm not in a hobby anymore. I gotta take care of business.
Yeah. Know? Tell me about that first, I mean, you get Boscarion, and it comes in and you're about to start painting and assembling like all the stuff. And when you get it, is there a moment that you realized, oh, this is what I'm going to do? This is it.
When I got my first run of Boscarions and I, DesignerCon was still in Pasadena. And I had a big line of people. I was pretty sure. I was like, this is what I'm going to be doing.
How many did you order of Boscarion?
I had 30, 30 in flesh.
Okay. And you painted them and the fact that you had a line, that means they were gone.
Yeah. They sold out. They sold out.
Holy moly.
But before that, I was just bringing squeak toys.
Yeah.
And people would line up for those. Also, I did take up resin casting too.
Okay.
I did. And I'd always wanted to do it. And mm-hmm. I found out about it and I really liked was the freedom and satisfaction it gave you of making something really small, really quick.
Yeah.
You know, I got a pressure tank, and I would make accessories for my figures, like mm-hmm. weapons and masks. And I did that for a while, and it was fun. I really enjoyed doing that. But I made trunk toppers for Boss Carrion and masks for Salamander Joe. And
how fun.
And I made actual articulated figures.
Yeah.
But and I sold them, but shipping a lot of damage. They were very fragile.
Yeah.
And I ended up having to fix quite a bit of them. But before I did my own resins, there was these two guys in Florida called Monster Hero.
Mm-hmm.
And I would send my sculpt to them and they would cast them for me.
How fun.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the way. I wish I would have known that early on, because I started in resin, and that would have been helpful to find people to just cast it for me. Because it's a process, though it taught me a lot and it showed me a lot about art. I hate it. I hate making.
It gets to be too much.
Yeah.
It gets to be too, it's fun for a while. Then after a while, you're like, I'm just doing vinyl toys from now on, because
yeah.
it's the mess. And then, but I would do, you know, you could do refrigerator magnets. It was nice to do for side stuff,
mm-hmm.
you know, or maybe just small things, keychains, little tiny figures, whatever.
Yeah.
But it became a little too much. I wanted to just concentrate more on vinyl.
Yeah. So you sell out, I mean, that show, you sell out, which is amazing. Do you immediately go home and
order factory? More?
Yeah, I need more. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Boss Carrion, aside from a revision, the molds did get that's another thing that happens. Molds get misplaced.
Yeah. Can you tell me about that? Because I've heard, let me tell you what I've heard, and you tell me if I'm way off base. I've heard that sometimes they get misplaced because sometimes they store them in these like giant things.
Piles.
And they really just don't want to try to figure out where it is. Is that true?
I have a feeling, I don't know for sure, but I agree with that.
Yeah.
Because they're heavy and they look at all the people making now. Mm-hmm. There's got to be piles on piles.
Yeah.
It's really strange though, because some of my older molds are found. They're there, but then a couple are completely lost, just gone.
Yeah. So when they lose them, do they help you pay for new ones because they lost them?
It depends on the negotiation.
Okay. Okay.
But they can take a vinyl that you have and make a mold off that.
See, I did not know that.
Mm-hmm. It's going to shrink a little more.
Okay.
But it's basically the copper, the plating.
Uh huh.
They spray this stuff that attracts the plating to the vinyl. And you think about it, when the metal's hot, they can pull the vinyl out.
Like, and still have it.
And still have it, yeah.
Interesting. So
they can be done.
Okay.
It can be done. But as far as the factory covering it, it's like I said, it takes negotiation.
Yeah. Because it's hard to, especially with the fact that molds, though they're way cheaper than like PVC or action ABS plastic molds, it's still a giant cost.
Mm-hmm.
And so if a factory says, hey, those molds don't exist anymore, that's a heart-wrenching thing to hear.
Especially a newer mold.
Yeah.
Yeah, because there's a couple molds I know have gotten buried and
Empire Blister. Empire Blisters. Specializing in action figure blisters. 247 Furniture, 1826. 19 different styles. Two sizes of clamshell figure cases. Four different bulk pack options. Quantities of 100 sample packs available. Empire Blisters.
Now functional. Toys on Tap.
That means a 10% off coupon on checkout. Use code Toys on Tap 10. That's COYSOMTAP 10.
Empire Blisters.
Empire Blisters. And unless you can find someone over there to go dig, which I doubt anyone wants to do, because I think they used to hang them from the ceiling on chains.
Yeah.
I doubt they even do that anymore, but that's what they used to do.
Yeah, the way it was described to me at one point was like there might just be a hole in the ground, basically, and they're like fishing them out. The hard part is I don't know how to tell someone this, but if they just said, hey, we'll pay for your flight, you go through all the molds.
I would do it. I would totally do that. I would go dig. I would totally go.
You and I would make a documentary then. That's what's happening. Okay, they lose your molds, so then you have to replace them.
Luckily, my buddy Don had the sculpt for Boscarion.
Great.
And I had him send Salamander Joe's sculpt. A couple got damaged in earthquake, like obliterated.
Yeah.
So Boscarion, I got him back, and I redid the nose so it poses.
Okay.
So it's 2.0.
Yeah.
And that mold's been fine. It's been used. I just recently did a release that went very well.
Amazing.
People still love Boscarion.
I mean, there's something about the fact that I think this is what's really cool about soft vinyl in general is that there's something cool about the fact that you started with that. And depending on if I can catch the notification in time, I can still get that piece now.
I used to do raffles. I used to do online lotteries, and I think it's just easier to just put them in the shop now.
Yeah.
I have to fill out and make the form, put it up. Some people would miss it and the form would go down and I'm like, well, this wasn't, worth having.
Yeah.
The lottery became really tough.
Yeah.
But where we did work out the lottery was for the live events.
Oh, you guys did so well.
Okay. And I always wanted to talk about this, where that evolved from.
Yeah.
The wristbands and all that. Because when I did a show in LA one time, there was literally people sleeping in the street waiting.
Oh my gosh.
And I was like, we got there early in the morning to set up the show, and there was people on the sidewalk, and I was like, we can't have this.
Yeah.
I don't want people having to sleep on the street, And so I talked with the gallery owner and said, look, we were at the time using tickets.
Yeah.
I go, everyone gets a chance,
mm-hmm.
And it'll prevent this kind of thing where people camping out and, so we did it and I thought it worked great. It worked really good.
Okay.
And everyone had a fair chance and it was random.
Yeah. So, I mean, what we're kind of describing is that after Boscarion drops, it goes wild and you just start producing more. So how many more figures, and then we bring in this lottery system? How many more figures do we start producing?
Probably up to my third figure.
Okay.
And then I started working with Toy Art Gallery.
Yeah.
And I'll have to say I learned a lot of sculpting with them.
Yeah.
And I would make a lot of pieces for those shows.
Mm.
But like I said, I didn't want people hanging out in the street all night.
Yeah.
So eventually it got to the point where people would come to our events and then collect a big stack of tickets. And
yeah.
I'd see them. And I called it bacon stripping.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, that's kind of a problem.
Yeah. That's just as bad as sleeping outside.
That's you can have someone just go up and collect, a bunch of tickets.
Yeah.
And you're sitting there with, it's not a paid raffle.
Right.
Like for a prize. This is just to buy an item. So eventually I've discovered the wristbands with this removable number. And those are perfect.
Yeah. So you guys, you do this. Tell me you're like three in. You've started this lottery system. What year are we talking?
We're talking about probably 2001, 2000. Wait, two. No, probably about 2005, 2006.
Okay. So 2005 or six, which, by the way, I'm 16 at this time. Toys are nowhere in my eyesight. So you're getting these going. You start the lotteries. This is kind of the boom, the big boom of what we can think about for like designer toys. And I guess now soft vinyl, where there's drops and people are lining up out the door for all these different things. You do this lottery system. And you're working with, I'm assuming, Aaron from Toy Art Gallery?
Yeah, I would I would be at Aaron's table.
Yeah. Yeah. And doing conventions and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
This is now full-time job.
Yeah. And
so what is that kind of feeling like, that something that you did starting with model kits is now the full-time gig?
I know. It was crazy, but that's just what I had to do.
Yeah.
There was kind of no choice.
Yeah.
You know, so it was great at the time. We had, you know, San Diego Comic-Con.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
At the time, back when I think the toy area was a little bit more
better. You could say better.
You know, and we would be at the table with O'Neill Designs and Matt and everybody, and me and Suck Lord and Awamo and Realhead all crammed into one booth. And we worked well. We, like a well-oiled machine, we would take our turns.
Yeah. That is a crazy mix. Because Sucklore is really resin-based. You're now really soft vinyl based. That is a crazy mix for one booth.
Yeah, it was pretty crazy.
Yeah.
And you had suitcases and food containers and everyone ass to ass.
Yeah.
But Matt was so cool for letting us do that. And I understood when it got to the point where he was going to give up the table, because he wanted, I had a talk with him. He's like, you know, you guys need to go do your own thing and spread like little flowers. Cause if you all share a table and have to maintain it with each other, you all destroy each other.
Yeah.
He goes, it'll wreck your friendship.
Yeah.
He goes, I don't want that. I'm giving it up.
Yeah.
So after that, we were, you know, that gave rise to SummerSlime.
See, I'm glad that you brought that up. Tell me the year that SummerSlime is thought of and created.
Years. I've been telling everyone how fast time has gone, you know, and it's like, I would say maybe, when was the first SummerSlime? I think maybe around 2010, maybe.
Okay.
I'd have to look it up, but it was in down, we had it in downtown San Diego.
Yeah. Is it in like the gas lamp area?
Yeah. In the gas lamp area.
Okay.
There was a guy who had a shop there, a clothing shop. And he said, yeah, you can use 5 and Dime?
Yeah.
5 and Dime. And he goes, you can use our shop. So it was back at the time when Amy was still with us, it was me and Amy and Luke.
Mm-hmm.
We had an event there, and that was kind of the catalyst for SummerSlime. That was like the first.
Yeah.
The first one. And then after that was over, the next year, I of course met Chica.
Mm-hmm.
And Chica had that wonderful spot in Old Town, and she offered it up. So I was like, yeah, let's do it, you know? And I contacted Buona Spoons, who I'd worked with, and John Rampage, and said, why don't you guys, you know, come out for this event and we'll set it up in this backyard. So that's kind of the SummerSlime we have now still.
Yeah.
Except Kwong took us in.
Yeah. So
Creature Bazaar.
I do have to ask how you ended up coming into contact with Buona and Rampage, because this is, you notice in the toy scene that like you spend enough time, you meet everyone.
Yeah.
That kind of what happened?
I met John at Javits Center.
Okay.
In New York for a con.
Okay.
That's where the first time I met John, and he gave me this little cupcake, resin cupcake. He said, can you paint this? And I go, do I have to? No. And eventually, you know, I got to John. I saw John start to make little vine. He makes, I what I always say is John brings the crack.
Yeah.
This is very small, cool little toys. And I liked his variety.
You know?
And Buana, I met during San Diego Comic-Con at an event called Nerdquake.
Okay.
In South Park.
Okay.
And they rented a bar and it was all the toy people show, all the toy nerds and community at the time showed up. I think I was there dressed in a gorilla suit.
Yeah.
and that's where I think I met Buana, but I called him Brian.
Yeah.
it was the first time meeting everybody.
Yeah, yeah.
And then eventually I got to know you're Buana Spoons, and he invited me to his show in Portland. And I flew up to Portland and
this is Gam Jam.
No, this is before Gam Jam. This was
okay.
It was at Grass Hut.
Okay.
But I did a show there.
Awesome.
Yeah.
You have Summer Slime, or the beginnings of it. It runs for a little bit, and I think if I have some history correct, that because of the promotional nature of San Diego Comic-Con, it almost becomes undoable because toys don't fit there as much as they used to. Mm-hmm. So at what point, what year did you recognize that was kind of what was happening?
I'm trying to remember the very last San Diego Comic-Con we did.
Yeah.
I think by the next event after that at Five and Dime, and then I think the Summer Slime, first Summer Slime after that, I realized that it had changed. And yeah. when people were just coming out for Summer Slime and not going to the con.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's, you know, it's like, you guys came from LA, you're not, you, because we had it in synchronized with the con. So when people came to town, they could hit Summer Slime, but it got to the point where people weren't even going to the con anymore. They were like, they would take the trolley, you know, people for a while, you know, maybe two people took the trolley. And I'm like, that's it? Why are we having it at this time?
Yeah, I will say that was the most interesting part of, if you fast forward to Summer Slime this past year or this past one, that I mean, the nature of Toys on Tap is that we talk to everyone, and hearing that people flew in from like New York for that.
That's, I will, amazing. Say
insanity.
Yeah, like, it's amazing.
Because when you come back to New York and you have to describe what you flew out for, it's really tough to explain. I went to someone's backyard in the middle of Orange County to do this backyard toy thing. It's really cool. So you have this realization. Tell me how you meet Kwong. Because there's this like realization in there and we want to switch it. And then all of a sudden we have Kwong taking over Summer Slime.
It's really funny. You know, sometimes you just have a friend that you really don't remember how you guys first started hanging out. But I think I'd seen him at a couple shows. He bought some of my pieces at some LA shows. And I think, you know what, like I said, it's really hard to remember how you gel with people.
Yeah.
But I think we were, what it was, okay, here's what happened. They were going to have their own event, Creature Bazaar. They were going to have, Burbank? Or I think Burbank.
Yeah, the show they wanted to do.
they wanted to do a show.
Right.
Creature Bazaar show. And then the pandemic happened.
Yeah.
And I remember, you know, talking with Kwong and I can't remember how long, you know, we were boarded up in the house for quite a while. And eventually it got to the point where we had to get back on the road.
Yeah.
You know, and
I mean, money is a real stressor when you're
locked up. Money's a real stressor. And then, so I think it was, had we moved to Anaheim, I think after we were in Anaheim for DesignerCon, right? And Kwong had asked me to be with them. And I'm like, well, I didn't get a booth, but yeah, okay, I'll be with Creature Bazaar this year. So that went really well. And I think we got in a discussion. He was asking me, so what's up with SummerSlam? I go, Chica had lost the moved.
Mm-hmm.
And it was beautiful. You remember, it was beautiful. You had a view of the airport, always mm-hmm. was a beautiful day of the year. But she lost it. She had to move.
Mm-hmm.
So Kwong goes, well, why don't we just do it? Because he'd been having, you know, after parties for DesignerCon at his house. We would all get together there anyway, and I'd pack the backyard full of drinking people.
Yeah.
You know, so Kwong's just like, just do it here. You know, he's got a really interesting house. It's, and I was like, perfect backyard, you know, not as big as Guns, but big enough.
Yeah.
So I was like, yeah, let's do it. You know, and I go, Guana Spoon's on board, John on board, you know, and we did, that's where we did the first one. And it was flawless.
Yeah. I remember, so 2020 is when I start in toys, and the podcast starts in 2021, and somewhere around like 2022, I heard rumblings of a show that was happening in a backyard. And the way that it was described to me was, man, I'll never forget this. It was like, in a backyard, invite only, paid. Those are the three things that were described. And I was like, well, how do I get an invite to go? Because that's where I translated it to.
Yeah.
Like, I needed an invite to attend. And just over time, hearing about it more and more, and then showing up finally, like finally figuring out and meeting Kwong and working mm-hmm. with him and doing those things. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was, you're describing it so well of like the perfect spot. Like 200 people in that backyard.
And there's never been a tornado.
Never,
It's always the most beautiful day of the year.
Yeah.
To me, it's the most beautiful day of the year.
It's great. It's great atmosphere, DJ, food, shirts, lotteries, toys. Like, it was cool. It was cool. And the way that it's set up and having you get on the mic and introduce and play around. And, yeah, it was cool. So that first year that you guys do that goes great. And this then immediately starts a partnership.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. We figure we got a good thing.
Yeah.
It's good for them. It's good for me.
Yeah.
You know, why stop doing it?
Absolutely.
It's great.
You know? Yeah. And so at this point, we're probably at 2021-ish. Mm-hmm. Or was the first one over 2020?
The one at Kwong's?
Yeah.
There you got me with the years again.
I want to say it happened COVID.
Right after COVID.
Yeah. Because I remember someone saying, the first description was, yeah, we just wear masks as we walked around.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We did have masks that first one at Kwong's.
Yeah. Which, what a funny thing. The guy that paints some of these doesn't wear a mask, but we're going to wear a mask.
So I wear a mask sometimes.
Oh, good. So you do that. At this point, you've also created a crazy amount of work and toys and soft vinyl that have come in, and you've been selling like hotcakes. And you've really solidified your place in the community long term. So when you do SummerSlam and you see that first one, I mean, and people are flying out. And Paul, if I'm like, can brag on you, they're flying out because they want to see you and your work and the community that you've created.
Mm-hmm.
What is that feeling?
I appreciate having the community.
Yeah.
I want them to feel appreciated.
Yeah.
And SummerSlam is how we do it. You know, it's not like other cons where it's like, oh, it's your turn to sell. I'm out of here. you know, and I've had that before and it doesn't feel good.
Yeah.
It's I don't want people to feel. There was a specific time where more of the same people were buying my stuff. And now it's starting to be new people. We want to bring new people into this hobby. Mm-hmm. We don't want to alienate anybody.
Right.
It's forever. We want people to know,
mm-hmm.
you know, at one time my stuff was, but you can get my stuff.
Yeah.
You just got to come enjoy yourself.
Here, yeah.
How dare you?
Yeah, like
you enjoy yourself.
You have put up so in being in SummerSlam, right? And I think we've talked about this. The favorite piece that you of yours that has been created so far is the dolphin things.
Iruka Gundan.
Yeah, which I don't know how to describe the feeling of when I saw it. It was like, oh, I want that. And then meeting, I remember going to SummerSlam this last year. And as I'm like walking up the table to buy something, I had talked to you a little bit. And I said, I introduced myself. Hey, I want to get you on the show. And you graciously were like, yeah. You didn't even know really what my show was. But you're like, yeah, let's do this. Sure. Mm-hmm. Which I will tell you that's not always the vibe that people give when I invite sometimes. Sometimes they're like, tell me about the show first before I say yes to this. And then I remember like walking through, my number was called. That was the piece I wanted, the painted ones. And someone from the back was like, Paul, you got to be on Toys on Tap. And I was really pumped to hear that from behind me. And it was just a cool experience to be able to go to a lottery that you had figured out. You'd figure out how to run it. My number got called. I got to hang out and got the toy.
And you got what you wanted.
And, well, my wife would have been really disheartened if I had gotten what I wanted, which was a lot of things, but I settled on one.
thanks. That set was awesome.
It is crazy to describe to people because I don't know any lore behind it. So when I tell them about it, I just say like, it's dolphin with guns on wheels, and I don't know what that means.
It's based on an old illustration
from
a kid's encyclopedia.
And whoever that artist was.
He did model kit box art of the tanks and stuff like that. But Kwong and Brandon and I in Blitzkrieg Toys would talk about how much we loved it. And I have the book. And we would stare at it and go, and one day I went, I'm going to make this.
Mm-hmm.
And I did. It was like that. I had it sculpted in probably 2 months and it was off and we did it. And Kwong made the boxes and got an artist to do the amazing box art and design the boxes, which are great.
Yeah, they're beautiful.
And for that initial first run, I think I made paint masks. Handmade.
Mm.
I think it must have been about 10 different masks to paint those. I always liked the first release to be banger.
Yeah. Oh, you did it.
I think the first release should be banger. And then,
because
people after that, you know, maybe a little simpler spray.
Mm-hmm.
If you put out a first run and it's not a banger, and then the banger comes out later, people are a little disappointed. You know, they're like, oh, now you release that one or. So I wanted that first run to be super banger.
Yeah. I will say it is one of my favorite pieces. I am shocked at how many pieces of articulation are in each of the dolphins, like each of the arms moves. And that's
the tail.
Yeah.
The guns had to be separate
because
or else they'd be probably bent up or weird.
Oh, okay.
So the guns had to be separate. The tank was easy.
Mm-hmm.
For the two different dolphins, you know, it's the one has an eye patch.
Mm-hmm.
Brandon made a resin cast of the one. And then I used that for the second one and just sculpted the eye patch and worked it into the little off-road vehicle.
Cool.
That's of course made up, not in the illustration, but the tank and the dolphin are from the illustration.
Yeah, it is. It was one of my favorite pieces because you got so much for what you paid. Reasonably three figures plus a head swap. which was wild to get in for what you paid for it. And so being there, doing all that had changed. Like, it showed me what SummerSlam was all about, one. And so being on this end, right? SummerSlam was what, in July?
Mm-hmm. August.
August. And
yeah, I can't remember that.
Yeah. And we are in October, same year, all these years into your career.
Mm-hmm.
Do me a favor, look back over your career. What are the things that really stick out, that really have like shaped who you are as a person?
Meeting other artists. I'd say hanging out, especially last Decon in Vegas.
Yeah.
I had such a good time with everybody.
Yeah.
You know, and that we got to blow off steam.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's, I think, my favorite time is getting the work done, mm-hmm. meeting people, and then going out and hanging out at the lodge and having a good time. And, you know, because you need to vent, you need to depressurize,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I think that's the golden moment, you know, when you're feeling good about what you did and it's done.
Yeah.
don't get me wrong, during the moment, like, you know, that's why SummerSlam, I get my old friend Lily to play records.
Yeah.
I don't get that for the crowd. I'm glad they enjoy it, but I get that for me.
Yeah.
Because it helps me relax and it chills me. Music soothes the savage Paul.
Yeah. You know, I will say you were very relaxed being surrounded by like 300 people. You were very relaxed.
Yeah. She creates the perfect relax. She soothes her music. The stuff she plays really soothes me and puts me in a good vibe.
Yeah.
You know?
Looking at this, then, we are at this current point and going forward. What's next for Paul Kaiju?
Well, I got Designer Con coming up here pretty soon, and I got a lot to paint. So I'll be back to that. Designer Con, the 14th of November.
Yeah.
In Las Vegas, again. I'm looking forward to it. It was, last year was so, you know, last year I didn't know what to expect, and it was completely amazing.
Yeah.
I never had so much fun at a show in my life. I recommend everyone keep the steam going.
Yeah.
DesignerCon's a real good thing. And then after that, who knows? I'll probably just be doing online sales.
Mm-hmm.
If there's leftovers, I'll have a shop drop the weekend after DesignerCon.
Yeah.
So if people want to check that out, you know, because usually there's a couple leftovers I can put up. And as far as just December, I don't do nothing. I don't do nothing.
Yeah.
I let everyone spend their money on stuff for their, you know, everyone's got enough to work on.
Yeah.
It's, you know, families and stuff. I just prefer to take the time and not do too much.
Yeah.
And wait till the new year. This last year, I sculpted all December.
Yeah.
Because I usually sculpt in the summer, because we're in San Diego. I can sculpt outside,
mm-hmm.
and cook my sculpts on the barbecue.
Yeah.
But this year I kind of screwed around the whole time. I roller skated every day and stuff. You know, I didn't really get a lot done. So I waited till December.
Yeah.
And I did all my sculpting when it's cold, and I get up at 4 a.m. and sit outside and sculpt in the cold. So I might be sculpting in December.
Yeah.
No. Hey. It depends if anything hits me, if something hits me.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I sculpted 3 figures last December. I think I might take a year off.
Yeah. I mean, if you take a year off, you got to at least come check in so we know that you're still kicking.
Oh, I'm going to be selling. You know, I have plenty of blanks to sell still.
Oh, good, good.
So, and to paint, they're waiting.
Nice. So. Paul, it is always so good to have you on here.
Great to talk to you, Abraham.
Thank you so much for doing this now 2-part episode. The last part is where we plug everything. And so, I mean, you described it. You're going to be at DesignerCon, so go see Creature Bazaar's booth. Do you have a booth number?
Yeah. Good question. I know. I don't write this stuff down. I'll be at Creature Bazaar booth.
Okay. You are booth number 1619.
Let me write that down. What is 1619?
1619. Yeah, you're next to... I can't remember what that place is. It's like Safubi Con. There's like a table and all kinds of stuff in that area. Global Figure Showcase, whatever that is.
Oh, that's Don.
Okay. Yeah, so 1619, so we're going to come see you. Are you doing any lotteries there, or are you just doing full sale?
I'm going to possibly do the lottery Saturday. I usually do it around 1 o'clock. Everyone come to the con. Get a wristband. I think I do it at 2 o'clock.
Okay.
Everyone show up to the con, get a wristband, enjoy the con, and come back at 2, and I'll be calling numbers. To form the line.
And there will be a line, for sure. Without a doubt. Hey, I'm so pumped to see you there. I can't wait.